with a geep shouldn't exist.
Do you feel that or do you think that?
I think that.
Okay, I'm glad, because there's quite a difference between saying you feel something or you think something.
Okay, that's fair.
Now, what is this geep thing anyway? I don't think I've heard of that before.
So I was in science class today, and we were shown a video of this thing called a geep, and apparently it's a hybrid between a sheep and a goat, or I guess a goat and a sheep, hence combining the two words into geep.
What do you do with a geep? Do you, like, pet it? Do you eat it? Do you milk it? What do you do with a geep?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it's some sort of domestic house animal that's supposed to be a companion or something like that. I honestly have no idea. It was just a really tiny-looking goat. Wow. And with no sheep qualities.
Who knows? Maybe 15 years from now, we'll be at a store somewhere, and there will be the latest craze will be geep wool sweaters instead of sheep wool.
Petco, now with geeps. How do you even, what's the plural of geep? Is it geep or geeps?
That's all we need. Deer, sheep, geep. We'll just keep going with words that can be both singular or plural. But, well, anyway, let's get on to business for today.
Let's do it.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to What's the Res, an ongoing conversation about the current resolutions in the world of high school debate. My name is Josh Herring. I'm a humanities instructor and debate coach at Thales Academy in Rollsville, North Carolina. I'm joined today by Ethan Delves. Ethan, introduce yourself.
Hello, listeners. My name is Ethan Delves. I absolutely love debate. And Josh and I decided to start this podcast in order to help forward everyone's knowledge of debate and share what we have learned through our debating and coaching experiences.
Excellent. And we should also be sure to thank our audio sound engineer, Noah Berman, for running the tech and
making sure
all of this happens. So if you enjoyed the intro music this episode, you have Noah to thank for that. Okay, well, today we are on to a different kind of episode. This is going to be a technique episode, and particularly focusing on debate partnership. And I hope we can kind of center all of this on a big question of what makes for a good partnership?
That's a really broad question.
It is, but I think we can get to some specifics over the course of our conversation.
I think so, too.
So, let's start with both of us sharing our different debate experiences, Ethan, in terms of partnership. Ethan, what kind of partnerships have you had in debate, and what events have those worked out well in, and how has that gone for you?
So, the two types of debate that I've done that have partners is public forum debate and Coolidge debate. So, I've done public forum for 3 years. I think I did it for 3 years. Now I'm mostly LD, but I have had, I think, two partners. Maybe three, possibly three for public forum. And I remember my favorite partner was Dallas Crenshaw in this, and we'd had this one really good debate together that was, as I said in an earlier episode, about the Internet of Things. And I feel like me and Dallas just really, like, we had a good connection as far as partners go. You know what I mean? Like, he was really good at some things and I was really good at other things. And when we combined our strengths, the round just went really well. And then in Coolidge debate, I've had a variety of different partners in Coolidge debate, which follows, what kind of format is that?
Coolidge is more like a modified parliamentary style format. Yeah. I mean, it's more structured than straight up parley in terms of what you're trying to do in each speech, but each of the rounds are shorter, but it's basically a parliamentary debate style.
And there's a lot of speeches in that too. Mm-hmm. So each partner actually gets the opportunity to make a constructive B question and question, as well as run a rebuttal speech. Mm-hmm. So I have had a lot of successful partnerships in Coolidge debate. One of them is our very own audio technician, Noah Berman. We won first place for the qualifiers last year and made our way to Vermont for the Coolidge Cup. So Noah, an amazing partner and an amazing audio engineer, sound engineer. So yeah, those are my partner experiences.
Yeah.
What about you?
So I only did one semester of debate in college, and that was the semester that Hillsdale College set the goal of winning Pi Kappa Delta Nationals. So for the 2010-2011 year, I was partnered with Andrew Dykstall. He's now moved on to bigger and better things than debate, I suppose. He's now a published author. He got a science fiction short story published recently. But that year, we worked together. We have both been on the speech team. We were both extempers, and we both decided we were going to shoot for this. And it actually worked really well because we had similar interests, we had similar convictions, and we had a similar style of argumentation. So it clicked really well in terms of moving forward in the debate and being able to strategize really well. So that is still, that's the only time I had a partner for debate. As we'll get to a little bit later, I also did IPDA, which is an individual parliamentary debate style. And I found that worked, but I really enjoyed that partnership. And by the time, and it really, I would still count him as a pretty close friend, even though we don't really talk ever anymore. It's been 3, maybe 4 years since we've crossed paths. But really, there's a tight friendship that grew out of that because of all of our work together on that partnership.
You should send him this episode to show him that you're thinking about him.
You know, I just might shout do that. Out. Yeah, it's we've exchanged email correspondences a couple times, but hopefully we can actually get together for coffee at some point in the near future. Well, Ethan, tell me what you think about why somebody should think about finding a partner for debate.
I think that there's a couple reasons. The first reason is just that two heads are better than one. It's important to have not only just two people, but two different perspectives that those people carry to bring into a debate. I think my best example would be Dallas, because Dallas took a very technical approach to all of the arguments that we had. And considering that it was public forum debate, this was really helpful because Dallas loved statistics. He loved research. He knew all of the greatest websites. He was the one who taught me about the CIA Factbook, which I love as a resource till this day. And I took a really different approach. Since I'm a more values-oriented person, I was better at first speaking and also summary speeches, which is the first and third speeches in public forum debate. And I like to tie ideas together, and I like to relate them to a common theme, even though that's not really what you do in public forum, which is now why I do LD debate, is because I'm very values-oriented. But I think having two heads on the same case is really important. I also think that it makes things just go faster because you have two people working on the same case. So that means research goes twice as fast and case writing goes twice as fast as well. One thing that Dallas was really good at, but I would help out where I could. And for a partnership to be successful, there's a lot of qualities that we really have to think about because, I mean, that's just two, but there's a lot of things that go into making a successful partnership.
Oh, there really are. Probably one thing we should add is that if folks are thinking about jumping into a debate style, they need to also be aware of whether that style requires a team of two, or as at least the last week I've been exploring reading about world style debate, and that requires teams of three. Wow. So depending on the style of debate, you may have to have a partner. And in some cases, I find that I usually enjoy working on things on my own rather than in partnership.
I would agree.
In part because I don't always have – it's hard for me to find people that have – where we really have the same level of work ethic that we bring to a project. I've been part of too many project teams over the years that really devolve into – one, if it's a group of three or four, really one person ends up doing all the work. Or if it's a group of 10 or 15, there's three or four people that actually are really good at whatever the project is. I tend to really rather just be in the position of it rises and falls on whether I actually do the work rather than be part of that team.
What part of the team were you? Were you one of the ones that laid back or one of the ones that carried all of the work or somewhere in the middle?
I was usually the last time that happened was it was a graduate seminar I did over at Southeastern Seminary where it was a hybrid weekend class, New Testament 2, I think, where one of the breakouts, the professor set it up where he broke us into teams of 15 where we had to go, we had all read the same book. And our team had to take two chapters of that book and create a PowerPoint and presentation and be ready to present to the whole group. Well, the trouble with that, I honestly ended up being one of the ones who I kind of sat back a bit more on that one because it turned into a mini popularity contest. And there were three or four people who just kind of immediately took charge and seemed to do okay with that. And there wasn't really any work for me to do. So I just kind of sat back and let them take charge. And I think I presented one slide of that. So
you had your glorious one slide.
Well, it was a really good book to read, but it was not a good book to present only two chapters of. Let's leave that as is.
Okay.
Well, I think there's several different, as you mentioned before, some different qualities to think about. Let's shift into that. Now, I think the first one of those qualities that are worth thinking about is really an equal skill level.
Of course. Yeah, I would agree with that completely.
I think part of that is that everybody comes to debate brand new. Everybody starts as a novice. But the trick is that if you mix novice with experience, it's not always a great combination.
Yeah, I think so too. I think I've had a lot of partnerships where I've been equally matched. I think my most equally matched was with Dallas, because Dallas and I were both rather new to debate at the time, mm-hmm. I think, or we were at least at the same time period in our debate journey, where we were both about 2 years in, and even last year, on our third year, we were about the same experience level, and Dallas had brought a lot of research experience from previous ventures that he had worked on. But I think equal skill level is really important, just for the same reason that you said, that pairing a novice with an experienced debater, you would think that it would help the novice learn, but what I've realized is that when novices watch varsity debaters compete, the varsity debaters compete at such a different level and in a mm-hmm. different way that it's skipping a step in the progression of knowledge and progression of skill that the novice needs in order to flourish in their debate journey. So I would say that pairing novice with novice and varsity with varsity is the best way to do it, or at least people maybe within a year to 6 months of each other, to help challenge each other, but also lift each other up at the same time. And I think that's what makes a healthy skill level.
Certainly from the coach's angle, I've seen, I've experimented with those kind of matchups before, and I had that idea like, oh, this will be great. My more experienced debater will help the newbie learn how to flow the round, will learn how to do a good rebuttal. Instead, it really only just ends up frustrating both sides, because what I usually see is that the varsity person is not willing to slow down and go back to where the novice person is to really help this novice come along in debate. And it's not a great win for either.
But then the novice gets frustrated because then they're unable to learn from the varsity competing at in a different sort of skill level or a different path that they have not yet come upon.
Mm-hmm.
But I see that when novices are together, I'm thinking of two in particular on a debate team that are new to debate this year, have competed together. I've actually debated those two novices together and won one time out of over 10.
Mm-hmm.
Because pairing two novices together is just so effective, and it works really well. And their minds they're two really good friends as well, which I think we'll get into later as far as friendships go. But yeah, pairing those two novices together was a great move on your part, because I just cannot stand against them. Even though I did one time, we debated about Santa Claus, and I won that. That was really satisfying.
I don't know that I can take any credit for their partnership. They both knew each other, and it's both of their first year here at the school, so they kind of naturally gravitated together.
That's right.
You know, one other thing that's important is that both partners have similar goals about what they want out of debate. I tend to see people coming into debate for at least these two reasons, and maybe there's other reasons as well. But there are plenty of people that debate once or twice and like, oh, this is fun. I want to debate because it's fun. But then there's other people that get into this, and I think I put you in this category. They realize it's fun, but they also realize that they really want to win.
Yeah, the fun thing, see, people don't try debate. That's the problem. That's like, look, if you're listening to this podcast and you haven't tried debate, try debate. Just please try it. Like, I know that you are listening to these episodes and getting things from it, but if you're not debating these things, like, go have at it, because I promise you it is a ton of fun. And everyone in the hallways are like, all my friends will look at me and be like, oh, what do you do, Ethan? I do debate. Oh, okay, that's funny. But literally, that's a reaction I get, but I promise you it actually is fun. And the second reason, there's a lot of prizes to win. But I think there's a third reason that I'd like to add to that, and that is some people debate to help forward their understanding of current world topics. Mm. Coolidge debate is a great example, because I know that some students get awarded extra credit for going to Coolidge tournaments, but when they go there, they're able to increase their knowledge of the topic, which actually helps them when they go back to school mm-hmm. and forwards their like traditional academic ventures, as I would call it, because they can now use that knowledge and apply it in their schoolwork, because the topic is usually rather relevant to what they're doing in school.
Sure.
So I one of the main reasons I debate, yes, because it's fun. Yes, I like to debate to win, but I also like to debate to increase my understanding of current world topics and mm-hmm. deepen that understanding off of a surface level.
Well, I think that definitely is a part of the puzzle. But the trick here, I think, is we're thinking about for whether two people should partner together for a tournament, is that they need to be honest both with each other and with themselves about what are they really in this for. If you have one person who's in this for fun and another person who's in it to win, eventually that partnership is probably going to break down, because the person who's in it for fun is not going to be willing to put the work in to win.
Right, and the person who wants to win is going to be a lot more stressed out than the person who's in mm-hmm. it for fun, which could ruin the counterpart to what you just said as well. So neither person is going to be happy in a debate partnership like that.
So I think a lot, going in the rest of this podcast, I'm at least assuming that the kind of people that are listening to our podcast are folks that are more interested in winning. They've kind of figured out, oh, I like this. How do I get better at it?
Yeah.
And so I think that's really who we'll be addressing in this. And Ethan, you already mentioned this a little bit as you were discussing how you and Dallas are two different debaters. But there's another piece we ought to consider is the different roles in a debate and the way some people tend to be better at one role or another. And so they really, a good partnership involves balancing each other out.
Yeah, so I think this kind of plays into the different types of speeches in debate because there's constructive speakers and there's rebuttal speakers.
Mm-hmm.
And usually when you have a partnership, it's pretty distinct and you can tell pretty quickly, even after one tournament, who kind of falls in what category. And I think that constructive speakers they're well prepared, they're well researched, but then remember in a public forum round, they also go down to the summary speech where they have to be really good at narrowing down a ton of arguments that they've had, lots of questions and cross-examination, but really showing the bigger picture, which I like to do when I was partnered with Dallas because Dallas was very research oriented. He took really fast notes. He could make connections really quickly in his head for rebuttal speeches and think about counter arguments so quickly I couldn't even comprehend. I was so grateful that he was doing rebuttals, but I had a prepared speech to give, which is nothing bad. Being prepared is completely fine because once I was prepared, I had a better understanding to go into the summary speech and tie ideas together based on the understanding that I had developed. Another person that's really good at constructive speeches is Noah Berman, our sound engineer. Noah is one of the best constructive speakers that I know. And when he, especially in Coolidge debate, goes up for that final rebuttal, Noah has developed such an amazing understanding of the round. He absolutely kills it. He's never yielded time. He's always gone up there with a great rebuttal, hit every single one of the points, and that has ended up winning us a lot of rounds because Noah gets one of the last two rebuttal speeches that Coolidge style awards. So for anyone who wants to do constructive speeches, I would recommend having a well-researched case to come out strong, then going into summary speeches, knowing what the big picture is, because a lot of the very technical second speakers, as the rebuttal speakers are called, who are typically the stronger partner, but not always, as Dr. Ben Voth would argue from the Coolidge Foundation. But the constructive speakers should be able to see the bigger picture when all of the arguments have become so convoluted and help let the judge see that as well.
Right. And that second role, though, is critical where the rebuttal speaker, and I think that in my mind is the harder job to have that, to be really strong in rebuttal.
Because on the fly.
It is. And that's the thing. That's the thing that people are usually most nervous about. Is that because for your constructive speech, you get to prepare it, you can have it all typed up, you know exactly what's going to happen in your constructive round, you can practice that. It is really hard to practice for rebuttal, because really for rebuttal, your main skills are thinking really fast, abbreviating whatever the opponent says in a way that you can understand, but you can write as fast as he speaks. And then you've got to be able to hit all of the points and come up with responses in at most 30 seconds of prep time.
And you can't miss anything. If you miss something, that hurts you in the round too.
Making sure
you're paying attention the entire time. And it's mentally exhausting too. As an LD debater, I have to give a constructive and a rebuttal speech. The rebuttals and cross-examinations are so much harder than the constructive speech because by the time the tournament comes around, I would have read through the constructive, at least known the mindset that I have to get into to argue either side. Once I get into rebuttals, you're interacting with both sides at the same time.
One piece that we kind of skipped is the cross-examination component.
Right.
And that's really something that, I mean, both, and we're talking about these as if these are always separate roles. I mean, really both partners need to be able to be in both sides. But usually one partner, as you said, is stronger in one than the other. But cross-ex is really a tricky spot because you have to have, on the one hand, you need a big picture perspective on the round. But you also need to be strategic in how you use your cross-examination questions.
Yeah, that is a really tricky spot, I would agree, because the big picture is those sort of questions where, like, is this good? Is this moral? Is this okay? Under your case, would this be able to happen? And usually, in my experience, it's the affirmative going to the negative and trapping them in some sort of moral paradigm where the negative can't squirm around or get out of it because they sound like terrible people. But for the not so big picture, when it's particular arguments, people get really technical and statistical, and those are the rebuttal speakers who are really fast on their feet, can pull those things straight out of the case, know exactly where they are. So yeah, both partners do need to be able to do cross-examination well and look out for the traps of the other team. can pose. But I really think that the different roles in debate is the most important factor we're going to go over in the episode, because if you partner with someone that doesn't match your roles in debate, you're really just, oh my gosh, you're just floundering aimlessly in the mm-hmm. abyss. It's so it can be really bad.
That's quite the image. I think I've heard it. The best advice I've heard from this actually comes from the church world, where one bit of advice that I remember getting from seminary is that if you are that as a pastor, you will have a certain set of skills, but no pastor has all the skills needed to effectively run the church. Handle preaching responsibilities, handle counseling responsibilities, handle hospital visits. Every pastor has a certain set of skills. But the advice we got in seminary was this line: you should staff for your weaknesses, where you know yourself, you know your gifts, and then as you're building a team around you, you've got to be on the lookout for the people who are good at the things that you're not.
So don't flounder aimlessly. Staff for your weaknesses.
That's it. Find that partner who, if you're over there floundering, a partner that you can lean on to hand you a lifeline, a life jacket, to pull you back up in the boat. Don't just leave you there to drown and sink in the round.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
That's it.
As my middle school PE coach would say.
I was going to say, I'm sure that's not original to her, but I know that quote from Ms. Sinar, so we can now tell her we gave her a shout-out on the show.
Indeed.
Now, one other thing that's probably worth noting on this that's unique to Coolidge tournaments, I've not been to any other tournament that does this, but Coolidge tournaments have a mandatory partnership requirement. But they're happy to let you show up without a partner.
And then what happens?
Well, then you get matched up with anyone else who shows up without a partner. And I've seen that work well. I've seen some folks who are incredibly flexible, and turns out they are randomly matched up with people who are equally prepared. So it works out okay.
This is shocking to me, this arbitrary blending of minds amongst students. But yes, I would agree. This does work sometimes, and one student comes in not so confident in what they're doing. They find that partner, that the crowd slowly and dramatically separates into where the partner is in their focal point of vision, and they see that person. That person comes up, introduces themselves. One, it's a great way to meet new people. Two, they realize that this person's a genius, and they click, and they work really well together because they meet a lot of the criteria we've laid out on this episode. But sometimes...
sometimes it just doesn't sometimes work out that way.
It is very unfortunate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for those listening, if you have the opportunity, just please know that it's not the end of the world if you come to a Coolidge tournament and don't have a partner. But if you have the opportunity in your school community amongst your friends to find someone who you at least know who you're signing up with, that's going to put you in a stronger spot with confidence than really the luck of the draw on day of the tournament.
And if you come to a Coolidge tournament, you might get to see the awesome setup of What's the Res podcast. Just as a perk.
Well, that's true. That is a possibility. Rather than promoting ourselves, let's get back to what we can do. What things that partners should do. So, Ethan, what advice would you give to people? You're in a debate partnership. What does that mean you have the job to do to be a good partner on your team?
You always have to back what your partner says. I've been in debates where your partner will take a different route than you will. So the constructive will be laid out. You're pretty much on the same page. You get to rebuttals, and the second speaker says something that you don't expect. Probably in response to something that the other team said, where the other team pulls some crazy argument, which I've seen some crazy arguments, and Dallas, for example, had to react to those in a certain way. The constructive speaker may not be prepared to go with that, but they have to go with it because what's already said in a debate is already said, and it can't really be fixed. Mm-hmm. Very rarely will people say, I yield that point, yet these still stand. It makes the argument or the case sound really weak. If your partner says something, you have to go with it, and you have to keep pushing forward that argument, even if it's not the most well understood, because what's important is that it's cohesive in between partners. Once you have that, then the case looks a lot stronger, and especially to the judge, where both partners remain on the same page, at least in theory.
I would completely agree. I mean, it's crucial on the judge and coach front that you see a team work together closely, and that involves trust. And you've got to trust that your partner knows what they're doing when they venture on something that's maybe off the case and unexpected. And you've really then just got to go with it. One thing that's also crucial in there is that both partners must flow the round.
Oh, my goodness. This is my weak spot in debate. I will admit, I flow the round kind of weird. You've seen my rebuttal conglomeration of markings on printer paper.
Yes, I have.
But you know what? I'm working on that.
Good.
It'll get taken care of. However, I was never able to form a system of abbreviation that my partner, both my partner and I, could use. I'm not sure of any partners that they do this where they have the same writing system, but I have seen some bizarre abbreviations. One of my good friends, Megan Bagwell, who was a partner for my for Coolidge one time, writes in a foreign language, and it's like some, but it's not just that. It's like upside down and rotated 90 degrees. Like it's this encryption of some sort.
She takes her notes in class. She takes handwritten notes in logic class that way, and it's her own shorthand method where she can get down word for word what I will say in a 20-minute lecture in class, and it makes it really easy for her to read. I think that's a great method, not necessarily on a team setting, because it's important that. You may be in a situation where your partner missed something on his flow and you need to hand him your flow sheet and say, and just point quickly, that's the piece you need, and that'll fill in that gap. Now, I remember one thing we did at Hillsdale was that, we had a very simple system of anytime something was positive, we would indicate that with an arrow going up. So lives will be saved, lives with an arrow going up. People are going to die, lives with an arrow going down. Econ is going to be benefited. Econ with an arrow going up, arrow going down, and so on. We just developed a shorthand so that, and really that was helpful for us as a team and as partners, that really helped us communicate more closely together.
Yeah, I think that flowing around together and with the same mindset and same abbreviations is important. I wouldn't argue that it's the most important thing. In my opinion, the most important thing is always back your partner's play and work closely together. Because I have seen debaters have a lot of success by having different flows. Although you're right, having a system that's together could very well fill in some gaps that occur here and there. But I have not yet developed a system like that, but I would be interested in trying it if I ever do partner debate again.
I think it's also important that both members of a team know both cases. This is a place where I want to really... I've seen this happen with multiple teams over the last 3 years where a team will approach a new case and they will immediately try to apply a divide and conquer mindset where member A is going to do the affirmative case and member B is going to do the negative case. And what happens in that is that if they don't work closely together and they don't both work on both cases, you've lost a lot of the benefit of the partnership.
I have a question for you. I kind of see two different routes with this. Dallas and I used to do the divide and conquer method, and it worked out okay. I think it definitely could have been better, but we did see some success in as far as picking up rounds went. What if one partner did the affirmative constructive, and then all they would have to do is, so if they did the constructive, they could give the constructive, and then the other partner would have to rebut against the other team. Then that other partner would do the negative constructive, and then the original partner would have to rebut against the other side. So like one team, basically, I know that was kind of messed up and all over the place, but basically what I'm saying, one partner makes a constructive for person A makes a constructive for a certain type of speech and then learns to rebut the other one. Person B makes a constructive for the other type of speech and learns to rebut the other one. Now both partners are skilled in giving a rebuttal for a certain side, yet giving a constructive for the same side, yet they really don't really have to touch the other side of the round. You know what I mean? Like, I would never do that because, in my opinion, I believe that understanding both sides actually helps you. So if you understand the negative, it'll help you build your affirmative case because it's targeted specifically at negative points. But what do you think of that first way? Because I feel like that's a strategy that some people would use as a really technical way of attacking the round without that really holistic mindset around it.
I could point out you're back to feeling on this one. Good. Keep thinking. Thinking is good. Feelings and thinking are different, and feelings have less of a role in debate than thinking does. Well,
oh dear.
I think that type of approach fits the natural inclination for students when they're approaching a classwork exercise and they're trying to accomplish the goal with a minimum level of effort. But I think that approach is going to lead ultimately to both members of a team being less flexible when they hit different arguments, because part of what happens when you develop a solid perspective on both sides of the argument is that you become better equipped to handle different arguments that are made. So if you only know the affirmative case, then you've not done the work to develop your perspective on the negative. If you know both sides, then you're better equipped to respond to the other sides. So I think you're going to be hampered in your rebuttal preparation because you haven't done the work to figure out what are the main arguments on the other side. I only know the one side.
Yeah, and I think that's part of one of my favorite things about debate is understanding both mm-hmm. sides and being able to argue both, because if you take one resolution and learn both sides, it almost filters down into your ability, like progressively as you do each resolution, to be, see both sides of any topic, mm-hmm. even if it's a real life topic, which is one of my favorite things about debate. And even laying out that strategy, I started getting so confused. Like person A, person 1.671, you know what I mean?
If you're going to work together, then you should just own the fact that you're going to work together. And working together is actually going to be what really benefits both people the most out of this whole process.
Work is good. The purpose of work is to carry a load. Humans have to carry a load. As Jordan Peterson would argue.
I had a feeling that was a Jordan Peterson.
Yep, it was a Jordan Peterson.
Well, maybe to wrap this segment up, I think what we're trying to get at is that both partners need to know each other's strengths and weaknesses. And a strong partnership is going to involve a lot of honest communication. It may actually involve the difficult conversation where partner A has to say to partner B, look, you're bad at cross-ex.
Ouch.
We should arrange this so that I do cross sex.
What would happen if one partner started crying when they were told something like that and they were deeply saddened by that fact?
Well, hopefully, if these are my students, then I'm probably going to tell them, assuming this is not the day of debate, because these conversations should not happen at the tournament. They
Agreed.
Should happen well before the tournament. So if these are my students and we're 3 weeks out from the tournament, I'm probably going to tell both people, you know what, we're done for today. We're going to take a break for today, and tomorrow we're going to sit down, the three of us, and we're going to analyze your partnership and figure out if what partner A said is true, and partner B, go ahead, we're going to take a break for today, go embrace yourself. It's possible the partner A is correct, and what we've got to do is do that difficult work of separating out the personal and the subjective feelings from the objective reality of whether or not the partnership works.
This kind of plays into the aspect of friendship and pairing friends together in a debate. Because sometimes friends, like the example I gave earlier from the two debaters that we know in your debate elective, do really well together. And it even ended up winning a tournament. But sometimes having friendships together in debate, it can be a shaky thing. Because you don't want debate as a very intellectually intensive process and very hard-working process to get in the way of any emotional or friendship ties. Because I would argue, while I love debate and I love arguing, my relationships with my friends are more important than that to me. Because, I mean, people are people, and arguments on paper are arguments on paper. I think being an LD, an LD debater, I can weigh those two values against each other. So in order to avoid any discrepancies with my friends, I would take more care in analyzing a partnership between me and a friend than I would between me and someone who's not a friend. You know what I mean?
So if I'm understanding you correctly, you're arguing that friendship is more of a benefit to a partnership than a harm.
I think friendship has to be very carefully worked around in order for it to work well.
Okay.
I think the most important thing for a partnership is meeting all of the criteria. If friends meet all the criteria, then no true negative discrepancies should happen in the round. But if they don't meet the criteria, I would say cut off that partnership rather quickly, because we don't want friendships to fall apart over simple criteria not being met as far as a debate partnership goes.
I'm tracking with you there. I think that makes a lot of sense, because the friendship is ultimately going to be more important than whether or not these friends can win a round or not. But and for our purposes here, if we're thinking about an ideal partnership, I think there's at least two qualities that we should avoid in that. And you've already brought up the first one. So you may disagree with me on this. It sounds like you lean more in favor of this than not. So I'm going to at least shell this out, and then you can tell me if you want to respond. As I would argue, I think in some cases, friendship is a benefit, but I think in most cases, I would rather have people who are not close personal friends. People who would say, yeah, we're friends, whatever, that's not that important. I think they actually will make stronger debate partners than people who say, oh, this is my best friend.
We have been best
friends since kindergarten, and that's why we should debate together.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think it's better to be, I don't want to say something sinister, as I don't want people to be emotionally detached from their debate partner. Humans are humans. Have good relations with your acquaintances. Even you can be friends with your debate partner, but the lower the emotional detachment that could cloud success or cohesiveness and around, it's just more effective. So take what you will from that, all listeners, in choosing your partners. Are there any other aspects that we should think about as far as?
Well, I mean, I think that really, before we shift to that, I do think the last piece we should note on really the friendship bit is that certainly I think this has, we have to consider the order of these things. I think it's much easier to see that if we work together in a successful partnership, you probably are going to become really good friends out of that. But the friendship there is founded on the debate,
right,
rather than bringing a friendship into the debate. Because the trouble with that is that debate, as you mentioned a moment ago, it's intellectually rigorous, and it often becomes quite heated.
Right.
So what you can easily have happen is disagreements on strategy, disagreements on workload, disagreement on goals,
right,
within that friendship. And it really becomes messy. And suddenly in that mess, it becomes really hard to figure out, well, I want this, you want that. It's hard to say, it's hard to have that objective conversation, and better to be able to approach that objectively from the get-go.
Yeah, and don't mistake debate for a weak foundation for a friendship, because I think you were talking about, you and Andrew earlier are really good friends, and your friendship was founded on debate. So debate is a solid foundation to meet new people and make new friends. So definitely don't let that fly under the radar,
because it certainly is. And I mean, even there are other folks, we got a good friend, Nathan, who we talk probably about once every 6 months. Another guy named Will. Nathan and Will were both the debate captains on the Hillsdale team my senior year, and they both taught me the vast majority of what I've taught you and our other debaters. And I would still count them as very close friends, forged in the fires of tournament competition.
I think that people who do debate together will tend to, their minds will get closer together. They'll begin to think like-minded. Because I just realized that we both said it certainly is at the exact same time. And I am freaked out by the fact that just happened while we're talking about cohesiveness and teamwork. Wow.
Well,
that was very convenient.
Yeah, that tends to happen when you work closely together, focusing on communication, that people tend to pick up similar communication patterns. But you were hinting at our next quality to avoid. What's that next quality to avoid, Ethan?
First, I'm going to lay out my thoughts, not opinions, on this. Romance and debate. Debate research is not the place to spend time with your boyfriend or girlfriend. This is just such a bad idea, because friendships are one thing. It's a solid foundation with two people who are emotionally connected and care about each other's well-being. Romance, especially at this age, just... if you think friendships can get messy, boy, you're in for a ride. If you're going to do debate with someone you're in a relationship with, if that gets heated, that is just so, that can be so emotionally stressful to both partners and detrimental to the success of a round or any tournament, the tournament as a whole, that it is just not worth it in my opinion or in my thoughts to even try something like that. Unless both partners are just so, you know what? Forget the unless. I can see you shaking your head. Like
You're, of course, as always, welcome to your opinion. But I will tell you, as I'm putting next year's parameters together, I am probably going to write this into a rule for our debate. I mean, just that I've had a class scenario in the past where I had a dating couple in the class.
Just
got awkward quickly, and so I would like to avoid just avoiding that kind of awkwardness is probably better for everybody involved.
And two things about that: one, I was just trying to find an exception because I do not want to underrate the merit of two partners who work extremely well together and strong-minded and hardworking individuals. Yet I could not find an exception because I feel like it's just a bad idea. And
it's just a bad idea.
It really is. Second, it's not worth it. But if you're going to try it, go try it. Hopefully it doesn't crash and burn. Good luck.
Well, I was thinking about this part of our show today, and it brought me back to some advice from St. Paul that he puts in his bit in 1 Corinthians, where he actually gives some marriage advice that this obviously is not equal at all to marriage, but I think it plays into our discussion of partnership as a whole. where St. Paul's command was, do not be unequally yoked.
Hmm.
When he's giving advice to people about marriage as a lifelong partnership, he reaches for a farming metaphor where two oxen would be yoked and they'd be pulling a plow. And so the idea there is that you can't unequally yoke your oxen. If you have a super strong ox and a super skinny ox, your plow is going to go all crooked. You're not going to get good furrows to plant your grain. And this is Paul's metaphor for describing a partnership. So when we're thinking about partnership, we want to avoid anything that's going to lead to unequal yoking of partners. Instead, we're looking for people that are pulling together in the same direction with a similar goal in mind and have a similar interest in excellence and victory.
I have an intuition. I think St. Paul was thinking of debate when he made this metaphor, specifically about debate partnerships. Isn't that convenient?
Well, you're welcome to that intuition, but I'm just going to tell you, that intuition is not going to meet the rising to true knowledge that we were talking about in class today from Socrates.
No, I reject my intuition.
So, okay. Well, in all of that, let's do take a moment as we're moving towards our conclusion to talk about the other another side of debate. Now, partnership is tricky. So sometimes it may very well be better to go to a style of debate that does not involve partnership. So, Ethan, is this part of why you like LD?
I do like LD for this reason a lot. I feel like I really enjoy relying on a partner, especially Dallas was just a great example. I would get so lost, and sometimes I would be just really, really lost, frankly, in a debate. And Dallas would come through and know exactly what he's doing and finish off the debate, and sometimes we would win. And I would be so relieved when I sat down and let Dallas take the wheel. As I've progressed in my debate experiences, I feel like it's easier to take responsibility for failure when you know definitively that it is your fault. Mm-hmm. I tend to blame things on myself a lot as far as debate goes, where if something goes wrong, there's only one person on the team. The only fault could be on that one person on the team. I tend to work better just by myself, even in groups in school. I like to work alone or work with people of extremely similar mindsets so that it's almost like I'm working with myself in a way, except with other people.
Sure.
But LD, one, I just love values. And two, it's just nice to be able to know that I have full control, especially just since I'm someone who likes order and control, which eventually I'll probably have to phase out of a little bit and let other people give their intuitions and take the wheel on some parts of projects. But for now, I like to have control, and I like to know that if something went wrong, it's my fault, which means that I have the capability to fix it on my own.
Now, there's also the plus side. I mean, if things go right, that's also your fault. I mean,
right.
So the
Am I being so negative? What am I doing?
I don't know. I mean, we're sitting in the same room with your fifth place, your fifth place trophy in the back, and your double octafinalist trophy. So you've got some wins even in the room that we're recording in today.
I'm sorry, guys, that was just really depressing.
But I mean, it does get to the heart, I think, of the reality of being solo on debate. I mean, it rises and falls on you.
Yeah,
and
LD is great. Being by yourself can be a good thing as well.
It can be. I mean, I found the same thing. I mean, I hear what you're saying about the control of the round. That was my favorite part about a second style of debate I did. Because at the Pi Kappa Delta Nationals, it's not that long ago, but it feels like it was a while ago. This was back when IPDA was a relatively new event. It's now become one of the biggest kinds of debate in collegiate debate. But in 2011, it was a new event at Pi Kapp, and so I was doing paired parliamentary debates with Andrew, but then I was in IPDA by myself, and it was in IPDA that I found I really, really soared, because I ended up making it all the way to semifinals by the end of the tournament, and the part of that was that I could decide all of the strategy. I could hold the whole of the debate in my mind, and I could see the moves that my opponent was making, and I could move immediately to counter without stopping to confer, without making sure that I said things in a way that my partner understood. I could do really all of it. And there is something pretty satisfying about that.
I would totally agree with that, because I'm of the same camp. I think that being self-reliant in that respect is a really healthy thing and a really good thing, but that does not at all downgrade the fact that being with a partner who has a completely different perspective than you, yet still goal-oriented towards the same goal, but they take a different route to get there, that can be so beautiful and so effective when two partners really click. And I've seen that happen, and I've seen them almost just flow perfectly together as if they're one person. It is a really great thing, but it has to, they have to do it right.
Well, that's absolutely right. There's a way in which solo debate can tend towards an awful lot of pride, where you can see yourself as the sole one in charge. Being part of a good partnership requires humility on both sides, because there's moments where both need to kind of follow the other's lead, depending on that skill set. Now, I remember at one point last year, I was talking with Dr. Voth about why the Coolidge Cup is set up the way it is. Because to get to the Coolidge Cup, you have to compete in pairs at all these tournaments. And even the Coolidge Cup qualifier is in partners. But then you get there, and they make you go solo. And part of Dr. Vogt's explanation was that the rationale there is that it really comes down to the wire to see, okay, you got here with help, but now you're on your own. And if you're really one of the best debaters in the country, you're going to be able to do both styles of debate.
Right, yeah. And it can be scary to go it alone, because the first trip I took to Coolidge, which was in eighth grade, I got in on an essay contest because I wasn't a high schooler yet. And none of your high schoolers wanted to write the essay. So took that opportunity right from them. But when we went there, the preliminary rounds were, or it was actually a camp beforehand, were partnered, and you got a partner. And I was so lucky to get partnered with one of probably the smartest people in the country and one of the best debaters at Coolidge. He taught me so much. I think we did 8-9 rounds together. I have never learned more about debate than when I was partnered with that guy. And he was just so good. He carried me through things that I didn't understand, like eminent domain and immigration as an eighth grader. I was completely lost. I still don't understand eminent domain. But look, at least now I know how to research it and debate about it. Well, should I want to?
Just in case anybody out there is now wondering what eminent domain is, it's when the government tells you that they have the right to steal your property and build a road or a hospital or a military base. It is technically in the Constitution, but I just tell you, I don't know of any property owners who are happy to get an eminent domain notice from their government that, surprise, we're stealing your stuff and we're going to pay you for it, but you can't say no.
I feel rather satisfied to now know what eminent domain is. I'm glad.
Well, satisfaction is a feeling, so you can, in fact, have the feeling of satisfaction.
I think rather satisfied.
Nope, you can feel satisfied.
Awesome.
Well, let's as we wrap this up, I think we've been talking a lot about partnership on this episode, but it's important to note that partnering with another debater really is one of the best parts of public forum, of Coolidge, of parliamentary debate. I think in part that's because, as we mentioned earlier, two minds are better than one when it comes to debate. There's an old proverb that says, where one falls down, the other picks him up again. But what happens when he's alone? And I think that's really a huge piece of debate, because often if you are on your own, it's completely up to you. If you royally mess up your round, it's on you. But there are plenty of times when you might really mess up the argument, but your partner is there to pick up the slack in the next speech, and he can carry out that argument that maybe you just introduced in the last 10 seconds, but your partner then builds on that to save the round.
Yeah, and that's just one of the beautiful things of a partnership, because not being partnered is a thing of extremes. You're either extremely unsuccessful because you lose all your rounds because of yourself. Well, it's not a matter of really winning or losing rounds, but it's like you take all the blame for losing or you take all the glory for winning. It's pretty much black and white. But if you're with a partner, you both share the glory and you both share the loss. It's almost like a mediation in between the two extremes that debate such as LD would have for it. And honestly, those are things just for different types of people. If you want to go it alone and you're okay with taking the loss, okay with taking the full glory, absolutely go for it. But being partnered with someone is an absolutely beautiful thing. It's a great way to make friends, and it's a great way to really learn with someone else and walk with them in a journey to understand different topics better, understand debate better, and just increase your knowledge about the world as a whole.
It also certainly keeps debate fun.
It really does.
And certainly, I mean, there's part of debate that's inside jokes and the fun of researching crazy things that most people don't know or care about. And having somebody to share that with makes it all the better.
Some of my best debate memories were with Noah Berman, sitting right here recording this episode. Noah and I have such great debate memories together, especially at Coolidge. Coolidge is just such a great trip. Noah, like, debate is just so awesome with you.
All right. Well, on that note, we're gonna the closing bit I would toss out there is that it is important for debaters to hold their partnerships lightly. Try out different arrangements, and certainly one thing I meant to get out earlier and didn't is that if you're in a partnership and it's that partnership where you're not willing to have a frank conversation with your partner, that is part of where having a good coach comes in. And it is worth reaching out to your coach to have your coach help mediate some of those relational difficulties. It's important to advocate for yourself, but it's also important to really bring the coach in to help with seeing whether that's a good partnership or not.
It's a great complete system.
There we go. Ethan, any last words for our audience today?
I honestly think that we have fleshed it out pretty well. I mean, those are our criteria for coming up with a good partnership and finding yourself a good partner, or if you should have a partner, or if you should not. I just think this was a really great episode. I'm really glad that we got to just get all this out, and now it can be a good resource.
Yeah, I think so. I hope I'll probably end up requiring next year students to listen to this. So if any students who are listening to this in 2019, 2020, hello from the past, and enjoy the requirement for tonight's debate homework. So anyway, more important than that, Ethan, just in case any of our listeners want to get in touch with us, how can they find us on the web?
If you want to get in touch with us at What's the Res, you can follow us on Instagram at @whatsthe_res or email us at whatsthe_res@gmail.com. That's whatsthe_res@gmail.com.
All right. Thanks for joining us today on What's the Res, an ongoing conversation about the resolutions in the world of high school debate. Join us next time for more What's the Res.